Mini episode 1850 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge mini episode 1850. I have with you here today FDH Lounge dignitaries Rick Morris and Russ Cohen. Russ Cohen, of course, the proprietor of Sportsology as well, 11-time author. And we are here to talk about the life and times of Hulk Hogan, who just very recently passed from the scene here. The most famous pro wrestler of all time by a very, very wide margin. Debates ensue, of course, about biggest money makers. There's him. It's almost impossible to compare on a per capita basis a century apart, but Jim Londos is somewhere in that conversation, Stone Cold Steve Austin, etc. But Hulk Hogan towering above all of them in that regard. For a smart mark like myself, there's, of course, the inverse quality between necessarily that level of fame and success and whatever and actually producing great pro wrestling matches, but he certainly produced many great pro wrestling moments, if you will. And one of the things I think that he influenced is, as we're recording this on SummerSlam weekend 2025, is the whole modern WWE, Russ, which is built around now, like, moments. You know, like last year when SummerSlam was in Cleveland, I was kind of, you know, ragging on some of my friends who went. I'm like, I hope you enjoyed being at Moment Slam, like, you know, where Roman Reigns comes out at the end. There's your moment. Or there would be this run-in at the end of the match and whatever. Right. And like the entire modern culture of moments that are hardwired into WWE begins and ends with the rise of Hulkamania in the 80s.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, we remember him as Thunderlips in the Rocky movie. That was a moment too. He had a big presence. There's no question about it. I mean, if you go back to the original like WWWF, when I watched as a kid, Vince was an announcer, and he did it with Antonino Rocca, who had a very thick accent. And, you know, so I remember it that far back. And so, you know, you go through the years, and one of the things that came up that I wanted to write about, and it has to do with Hulk Hogan. Hulk Hogan is one of the New York broadcast radio guys was kind of like, hey, maybe the Madison Square Garden should hang a banner for Hulk Hogan for all the, you know, the matches he had there. Mm-hmm. And I was like, hey, sounds like a great idea if they do that for Bruno Sammartino, who actually sold out MSG more than any pro wrestler in the history of pro wrestling. Yeah. And so like, but this is the whole thing. Hulk Hogan's presence is so big that there is like a generation of people that are just younger than us, but not old enough to realize that, hey, they were, you know, as big or bigger guys at that time than him. And then he got bigger because of the advent of television, the advent of other things that they did, the cartoons and all that. That definitely helped his fame. But, you know, a guy like Bruno Sammartino just went out and wrestled. Like he didn't have I used to watch house shows. Like they were free on cable with your cable. Yeah. So I used to get all the house shows from MSG and Nassau Coliseum.
So Prism in Philadelphia did the same.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so you just watch that as your part of your, you know, cable package, like until everything started to change. And you know, you talk about the WrestleManias. And so another interesting thing about that, why I watched it now, who knows? The 30 for 30 on Ric Flair, who, again, was one of those big money makers, right? Mm-hmm. He couldn't have made as much as Hogan because he didn't make as much in the NWA and they just didn't pay as well.
Right.
He wasn't as popular. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that really struck me was Flair said that when he signed with the WWF, still was WWF at the time until they lost the lawsuit, which I was happy about, by the way. World Wildlife Fund had it first, so too bad. That's just the way it goes in business, right? But what I didn't know is I went to one of the house shows with Flair and Hogan at the Spectrum. Mm-hmm. And it was an amazing thing. And I was already like, at that point, you know, 30 something year old guy, but I wanted to see it because mm-hmm. we wanted to see that for 20 years. Everybody did, any wrestling fan. Mm-hmm. What I didn't know is they only did 10 of them. But what Flair said in the 30 for 30 was, hey, they had to kind of fill the coffers. So they used us for that. And then they changed them last minute for WrestleMania. And so, like, I'm glad that I went and saw that mm-hmm. because I wouldn't have gone to WrestleMania that year. I would have watched it on TV. Sure. I'd have paid the pay-per-view the night. Well, back then it was probably $50. I'd have paid the $50, but like, I didn't realize they just only did 10 of them. And that killed the WrestleMania moment, as you like to say.
Yeah, that is true. And again, you know, you talk about folks younger than us, you have a recall of things that were slightly before my time as far as Bruno goes and that kind of stuff. But yeah. I can tell you from watching, you know, secondhand, so some of the very things that you were watching back in the day, that Hulk Hogan, what he did in the 80s, it's one of these things where it was a revelation on the occasions when he would go to New Japan. Because he would bust out a whole bunch of stuff and it would be like, oh, this guy doesn't just suck in ring. Like, he could be doing this, but chooses not to. And
he
it was like
three moves in a match. Yeah.
Yeah. And like he used a dumbed down style. And that's the thing here where, again, I think it was embedded into him, the philosophy of Vince McMahon. But what he'd seen from his father, because one of the great revelations to me as I was watching old Bruno matches and even Bob Backlund matches.
I didn't like Backlund. He was boring for me.
Well, but both of them, punch and kick and slam, punch and kick and slam. But y'all in the Northeast were on your feet. You were enraptured. Right. All of you were enraptured by this stuff. I'm just sitting here like, what?
And I'll tell you why.
Okay.
The reason why is, so like Bruno, as an example, like with his – he was on the cover of Sports Illustrated, I think, mm-hmm. doing, I think he set the push-ups record or something. Yeah. And he had David, who, as we know, was not the lightest guy in the world, mm-hmm. On his back while he was doing them. So he was just like this workout fiend. And you knew about how much at that time, this is pre-Ken Patera, what he mm-hmm. could bench press and do. So it was pretty astounding. So like you already bought into that. You were like, okay, this guy's a strong man, but he's also a really good wrestler in the sense that he knew how to get the emotion out of people. So when he was going up against Luna's father, was it Mad Dog Vachon?
Mad Dog, yeah.
You know, like these were like real big grudge matches. There was blood. Bruno sometimes, one of the times he was getting whipped by somebody, he only had one arm because the one arm's all bloody and he's beating up the guy with one arm. Like mm-hmm. just got invested that way because you knew that wrestling wasn't real, but you still thought there was some hate between the guys, and that sure. was still good.
Well, yeah, and it was a lot easier to believe, like in the case in 1976 of Stan Hansen, who accidentally dropped him on his head, broke his neck. A lot easier to believe there's bad blood when somebody gets legitimately hurt like that. But it's one of those things where the late, great Larry Matisick, a guest on the show about a decade or so ago, from the pro wrestling at the Chase era in St. Louis back in the day and chronicling the whole St. Louis scene at the time, which was like the bastion of purity in America.
No, I lived in Memphis. My cousins lived in Memphis and I went and researched this because I was about 8 years old, maybe 10 years old. And I saw like the famous kangaroos in Memphis.
Oh, okay. Well, St. Louis really looked down on Memphis for being sideshowy and everything. But I will say this, Larry Matisick chronicled that like Sam Muchnick did not like to use Bruno there. So like Bruno, he was a product of a day and age of when it was still a territorial system because that didn't really travel. That style didn't travel outside of the Northeast. Hulk Hogan managed to, in the 80s, make this homogenized style travel everywhere. And like, that's a very backhanded thing for me to tip my cap to him. But I mean, for a guy who, again, knowingly dumbed down his style, wrestled repetitive matches and everything, every part of the night was built to the crescendo of him posing afterwards and ripping off his t-shirt and stuff.
Yeah,
like that.
That got old after a while.
He made it work.
But he did make it work.
He made it work. Yeah.
You know, here was the other thing, and I didn't know about this until now, that something happened between him and his daughter, Brooke, and they're estranged. And I saw that, I forget his first name, but Alexi, the former hockey player that she's married to, came out and talked about this. And so here's the thing. So I interviewed Hulk Hogan once at the 2004 Stanley Cup when the Tampa Bay Lightning were in it for the first time.
Okay.
And there's a, if you go to Sportsology, there's a picture that a friend of mine took of us. Well, not of us, just of him. And because when I was interviewing him, and he agreed to do the interview if he was allowed to talk about Brooke because she was singing the national anthem. So for me, it was like, hey, it was great to get in a few questions with Hulk Hogan. I had no problem with him pushing his daughter. And at that time, it just seemed like, hey, he's a dad doing the right thing. But as you know, things always seem to go astray with some of these big time wrestlers.
Yeah, there are. And that's one of those things, too. I mean, there's a lot of times where you do something and it has to go a certain way on things like this. I remember being peppered at the time that we had Steve Perry on the show of like, oh, how come no questions about him getting back together with Journey? I'm like, do you think I would voluntarily not go there? Like, right. I mean, like, come on. People are dumb when they, you know, you have to play by certain rules sometimes when you get these big time interviews. And that's one of those things where, like with Hogan, he tried to curate his public image, you know, as best as he could. But it's one of these things where, again, it's very, very interesting that, like, it didn't exactly parallel the start of the NWO storyline, because in the early 90s, when things were coming out about the admitted steroid use and, like, you know, like, OMG, shocker, he lied about no steroids.
Right. But
it seemed like once he'd gone Hollywood Hogan, that like, and supposedly, I mean, if you listen to the account of his career, like, I was afraid to do it because people believed in my wholesome image and whatever.
Sure.
Exactly. But it's like, it is interesting that like, it wasn't immediate necessarily, but the cork came out of the bottle basically on the skeletons about the man. And as far as how he, you know, he conducted stuff outside. I mean, his
in-ring, how he basically ran WCW. Well, essentially.
The politicking was known at the time. There was a great Bruce Mitchell column in the Torch in 98 about this. And like that, this is the, like, as WCW was cratering about how it was all attributable to his backstage manipulations.
By the way, I ate at their restaurant with my buddy, Doug Cataldo, who helped create Sportsology in Vegas. I ate at that WCW restaurant, and there was a wrestler there that day. I don't know if it was Buff Bagwell or it was Too Cold Scorpio. It was somebody like that. It was
they
funny.
Don't look anything alike, so I'm surprised.
No, but it was just like they weren't there signing. They were just there to be seen, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And that's Scorp was gone but from there by then, so probably not him. But yeah, no.
It may have been Bagwell then, maybe.
How was the food?
Food was okay. Like we liked it. It was a decent place. It was like when I went to Mickey Mantle's restaurant, and Jason Isringhausen was there that day. Oh, he just probably went because he is a ball player and he figured, I'll go check out Mickey Mantle's restaurant. Like, why not?
Yeah, exactly. And so that whole thing that his career as it went along, these things that would start coming out beyond the backstage manipulations, which were known. I mean, as soon as the internet became a thing and the dirt sheets blew up in the late 90s.
Yeah, and those DVDs go around, the shoot DVDs.
People dealing with stuff with him. But then, you know, subsequently to that, the whole thing with the sex tape that comes out, Bubba the Love Sponge, of Hogan and his wife. That was the one that actually won him a lot of money in the lawsuit with Gawker.
And by the way, people should give Bubba the Love Sponge a break, because he really did break the news that Hogan was very ill, and people killed him for it because it got denied. But that kind of stuff always gets denied. Like, people should know that.
Yeah, and by the way, I mean, whenever the individual themselves is not part of the denial, that should make you wonder. The fact that Hulk was never out there like, I'm in good shape, brother.
Right, and you know, and the thing was, like, somebody, I saw the next day after Hogan died, somebody actually, like, they just tweeted to Bubba the Love Sponge and were like, oh yeah, you were right, I guess you feel better about it. It's like, he doesn't feel good. That's his friend.
Well, I don't know what the status of their breaking.
Well, I mean, he was friendly with him.
At one time.
At one time.
You know, pre-cucking and pre-release of the tapes exposed Hogan as a self-admitted racist. So, I mean, I could sit here and say that there is great fitting quality that we're doing this as mini episode number 1850, because to listen to Hulk Hogan on those tapes, you would think to yourself, well, there's a man that would have approved of the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850.
Right.
But there that's where, yeah, it all ties together in the FDH Lounge. But as far as how that went, his failure to ever it's one of those things where it's like, again, you can apologize and whatever, but as far as like to show contrition, whatever, but a lot of the black wrestlers subsequently, again, they never felt from him that it was any kind of a legitimate kind of apology or contrition or anything right. like that.
And he didn't do the work at all.
Well, and then like, When he was called upon to address the wrestlers, you know, when he was, you know, coming back and first being reincorporated into the mix here is more so it was more like, be careful about getting recorded here. You got to be yeah. careful. Somebody's always out to right. get you. Like
that yeah, wasn't sound... like do the right thing. It was like, don't be stupid.
Yes. Yes. It's like, you know, it's one of those things where, again, he just how it and. Perhaps he is somebody who had grown cynical about his ability to apologize and to have it, you know, like nobody's going to believe me anyways, but it's a thing. Like,
you know what? You still do it. It doesn't matter if you still right. do it. If you're brought up right.
Yeah.
And obviously he wasn't, you do yeah. it.
Yeah. You got to try. You got to try. But it was like, he was so half-assed, and particularly as his life went along, where I'm at on America's North Coast here is about a year ago. He was in Medina, which is a southwestern exurb of a town here, promoting his Real American Beer. I actually think I had a friend of mine or two of mine that were, I think Tony Mazur, a lounge dignitary, may have been there. But he's there and he's doing things like, I don't remember what it was, but like throwing a beer out there and like some woman gets hit in the head or something like that. And it was like, oh, hey, I'm sorry about that. Like, what? Like, that's it? Like, you know, oh, just must have slipped out of my hand. Like, whatever the explanation was, I don't remember the specifics. I don't want to say that there was a specific thing, but it was handled so sloppily in terms of PR and just basic human decency, too, that like... So again, I think we're walking real close on that thing here of like speak ill of the dead, but like
well, he but here's something,
you have to tell the good and the bad. I mean, I'm not saying he was a bad guy overall. I'm not saying that's the thing, but there was good and bad, and we would be intellectually dishonest if we only talked about one side of the coin because we wanted to, you know, have decorum. You have to talk about the whole thing.
You do, and it's fair to bring it up. Something else that is now sort of interesting. I found this out after. Playing a charity softball game that I do for the BK Memorial Fund in New York, around New York, in Brooklyn, is that Hulk Hogan had a bar that's opening up in New York this fall. And it's a $7 million project, Rick. And it's a 9,000 square foot venue. And now the other partner, Rich Rosen, says it's going to be a living tribute to him. I don't know if he said that before or after. Nope. It looks like he said that after. Okay. And so I believe, anyhow, from what I could tell on here with AI. But at any rate, he didn't get to see that bar open, and it's right across from Madison Square Garden. So I imagine a lot of wrestling fans are going to go there in tribute to him.
Yeah, and look, Hulk was enough of a carny. I think he would be like, oh, that's very fitting, brother. Like, you know, I don't think he would object at all. But it's a thing. And again, like I said, you mentioned the good and the bad side of the coin as well. The good side of the coin would be, again, a lot of charitable work, a lot of things that he did for sick kids.
Yeah.
And that, again, there are people who would, you know, talk about, you know, how other wrestlers would have the image.
Yeah, he entertained us. Like, we were entertained.
Yeah, you know, that's true. And the moments out there, I mean, as far as like the moments that he created that are basically sort of like, you know, the template for today, you know, him and Andre staring each other down WrestleMania 3.
Yeah.
Him and The Rock staring each other down WrestleMania 18. And
I was there for that. So
that's for
Mark. I watched the changeover when Hogan, you know, when The Rock had to change for Hogan.
Yes.
So that was, and that was interesting.
And as the Toronto crowd goes into business for itself on that occasion. And that was the thing where I remember on the show, FDH Lounge dignitary Kyle Ross saying and just being so angry at that crowd in Toronto that basically, because like within a month, they've done the panic move of strapping them up again. Let's take over the hill Hulk Hogan and strap them up one more time, only to like take it off of him almost immediately and put it on the Undertaker. But like it pushed them into doing
Flair Undertaker was one of those matches too.
Flair Undertaker was on the card.
That was a good match. That was a really good match.
Well, and for somebody like me, the mark-out moment of the entire show is Arn Anderson running in and hitting the spine buster on The Undertaker. I mean, I'm an old-school NWA guy. I'm going to mark out for that.
I mean, Jericho had one of the best matches. I forget who it was against.
Well, it was Triple H in the last match, but like the crowd was kind of dead for that one, if I recall. But the match was good. And that was a thing where... him and Triple H should not have been in that spot at the end. There was the old school spot. You put the title match on last, but it couldn't follow the spectacle of Hogan and The Rock. And that was the thing that Hogan, for much of his career, and that's what's interesting is by 2002, and this is what absence will do. He'd been away for about 2 years because ever since the disastrous Bash at the Beach 2000.
Which I watched on Dark Side of the Ring or whatever that's called. That was funny. Yeah. I didn't know a lot of that stuff.
Well, and then I think that was actually the same building and everything as Bash at the Beach 96. I think it was Daytona both times because a lot of times they would run Daytona for that. So it's like one of the highest moments of his career to 2000 where it just epitomized the death of WCW. And that, again, Hogan had by 98 legitimate go-away heat. You could maybe even say a 97 because he wasn't the one powering the NWO as much as I would say, you know, basically Hall and Nash and being the legitimate outsiders. He was a big part of it until he basically wasn't and people soured on him just as they soured on him as a fan favorite. By 2002, he's in ascendancy again. He's a hot thing. But then he burns out within the year. By August, he's going away because he's demanding that in order to job for Brock Lesnar on SmackDown, that he get the win back at Survivor Series in Madison Square Garden that year, to which Vince was like, well, you do the job now and we'll get back to you on the Survivor Series thing. So one of the times Vince got the better of him, of course. So that's the thing.
Vince, look, Vince got the better of everybody at some point.
Yeah, they did. And then, he does the very memorable WrestleMania match with him in 2003. And again, so many spectacles that were a part of his career up and down. But that's where, again, you talked about Ric Flair previously and that the parallels between the two as far as the biggest stars of their respective promotions, you got to see them intersect in the old WWF. That would have been in 91. They intersected repeatedly in WCW in the mid to late 90s. Yep. There was a match I saw recently on one of these Smart Mark message boards where somebody said the best match of Hogan's career might have been when he was fresh off the turn in 96. He did a Clash of the Champions match against Flair, who was basically the de facto face in the match. So it was the first time you got to see the different dynamics there. But that was a thing where, again, the ups and downs of his career, but Flair was always... like you said, I mean, the NWA, he was the top of the pyramid pay-wise, 10% of the gate, everywhere he went, whatever. But they didn't have nearly as much money, mostly because of the merchandise.
I used to laugh at some of those matches. The ring was small. The audience was small compared to the WWF. Like, you know, me sitting in New York, I was like, wow, this is a real small-time production. But you did want to watch some of their guys, and he was the guy you wanted to watch.
Well, they would do studio shows for their TV. That was one of the primary differences. But Flair, because of the promotion that he was in, Flair was always the icon of work rate versus Hogan being the showman and everything like that. And Hogan being sort of heir to the legacy of Bruno Sammartino in that way, the larger-than-life guy, but not the guy that's Meltzer's not giving Hogan 5 stars in a match the way that he's going to do with Flair, the way that he's going to do with the modern guys. So Hogan's a guy that a lot of these guys grew up on. He's a guy, but he's as far as like who gets emulated more, by far, it's Ric Flair and a lot of the guys today. It's actually Bret Hart. Like Bret Hart, for sure. Bret Hart is a guy. Ricky Steamboat, to some degree, maybe the Macho Man. Like Hogan is way down the list as far as like, I mean, even somebody like an Alexander Hammerstone, who is, you know, you might look at him like on the surface, got a lot in common. I'll bet you he was probably more emulating other guys, even if his look is largely the same. So this is one of these things where, again, his influence, you know, it was more so writ large, pop culture, you know, the business at large, drawing the gates, drawing the buy rates. And that was something that basically, as a backstage politician, this is where I start to get into the lack of compliments here. Well, where he was able to wield that as a weapon and when he went to WCW, even though he couldn't draw at the same level anymore.
No. But here's another thing. So, you know, we brought up Flair and we brought up Hogan, and now you mentioned Bret Hart. Mm-hmm. Bret Hart was the most famous guy in Canada for a while. Like, after, like, Wayne Gretzky retired from hockey, he was the most famous guy, athlete they had. And he was massive. Like, I interviewed Bret Hart. The interview is still up on Sportsology. It's one of the things when we had to redesign the site once, and I had literally a couple hours to port over anything from the good old days back like 15 years ago. So I got as many old stories as I could, but I wanted to make sure I saved this Bret Hart interview because I got to interview him. Mm-hmm. And he told me about a commercial he did with Wayne Gretzky, and Wayne Gretzky put on the tights. So you can go and look for that. It's a McDonald's commercial. But Hart also told me how he took care of Wayne Gretzky and made sure he didn't get hurt, because he did not want to be responsible for Wayne Gretzky getting hurt because of him. Because just imagine what the blowback would be for that.
I can imagine. Yeah. You don't want that to be the case. And that's the thing where,
but he was tremendous. Bret Hart was one of the best wrestlers ever. I mean,
yes,
easily.
Yes. And this is one of these things where, again, and to a lot of the people that hold up the iconography of Hulk Hogan above all else, of like, these are people that are marks. They're like, the business was invented in 1984. Yeah, there was nothing but smoke-filled tiny arenas before that. Like, as you pointed out, Bruno sold out the Garden more times than anybody else. Like, wrestling on a regional level was super strong in the 70s. Like, you know, you didn't have, like, household names because it was, like, nobody was national. Vince Jr. took it national. Hulk Hogan became the guy that he was building around. You know, together they changed the business forever when they did the national expansion. It was the start of shows like WrestleMania, where, again, there had been stadium shows previously. And I've talked about this on this show, that this is one where, I mean, I think it was a big white elephant of a show. But right here on the North Coast Cleveland Stadium, 1972, I forget what the name of it was. The old NWF did a show at the stadium, and I've had to read about this because it was before my time, but it was like they were going for the gimmicks of, like, they had like three rings and were running matches simultaneously. Like, it was just like, what are we even doing here? And I don't think they drew any kind of a crowd whatsoever. But again, as you would know, being in New York, 72, 76, 80. We talked about it in 76 with Stan Hansen, where that was the undercard for Ali and Oki. But the shows at Shea Stadium.
Yeah, I watched years, it.
There would be the shows that would be there. Bruno and Larry in 72. Bruno and who was it in 72? Who the champ was? Pedro Morales.
Pedro Morales, yeah.
Yeah. And so that was a thing where, again, wrestling existed on a larger level before Hulk Hogan. Again, you go back to the 50s, and it basically burned itself out from being on the DuMont.
Yeah, my dad was a teenager then, and he would watch Gorgeous George and all that.
Yeah.
He got out of wrestling when Bruno was getting in. So when I was younger, my dad and I would watch with Bruno. And,
okay.
And my dad's still around, but he would watch some of that with me. Yeah, it's interesting. I didn't go to that many house shows over the years, but one of the other ones I went to is, I lived in Virginia for a while, and so I went to the Richmond Coliseum in 1988.
Okay.
That was, and so back then I went and saw, like, the Powers of Pain did like a run-in, and that was instead of Can-Am Express, and I can't, oh, they were, it was not, it was, yeah, Powers of Pain against, maybe it was Axe and Smash. I think it was against Demolition. I think they did a run-in against Demolition, right?
Okay,
And also it was like Savage and DiBiase on that card.
Mm-hmm.
Tito Santana was probably on that card.
Okay.
You know, and it was – so just to point out that was a regional show that had a great crowd. Like, Richmond Coliseum was a great place for wrestling, and it was probably sold out.
And that's actually, I'm going to hone in on this part of it. That's actually pretty funny that they would use the Powers of Pain there, because they would have been fresh off of a jump from the NWA, which ran regularly in, you guessed it, Virginia. So nothing like using them in the market that they just...
Well, I was shocked. Like, you know, it was one of those things, like, from a house show, you're like, oh, look at this. And they like tested them, and then they got into it. And they weren't in WWF for long, but they were there for a little while.
Well, not as a tag team anyways. They broke them up, and they got longer runs as a solo thing. I always felt like one of my guilty pleasure tag teams here, ultimately, they tagged together, I think, at a WrestleMania just as a throw-together thing from the Heenan family. But the Faces of Fear, Haku and the Barbarian. Like those guys together were really good because both of them were underrated workers. And in WCW, they had some really, really excellent stuff.
They were here better than the Mega Powers? Are you for real?
I would watch their matches over the Mega Powers, certainly any day.
Wow.
But you talk about the Mega Powers. I've heard it described as, I think Dave Meltzer described it as the biggest storyline in company history with Hogan and Savage. The full
it was pretty funny to watch them do the promos for that.
Yeah. And the whole thing, too, of like, I was just talking with somebody recently off here talking about this and the whole thing of like how much they actually, how much the Hogan character, if you scratch the surface even a bit, was actually really a heel, because like all the Jesse Ventura stuff was truth telling.
Right.
That was like when he would do these, like Hogan's really, you know, like undermining Savage, whatever. And it was like all the things that Savage would end up citing months later when right. he did the turn. And it was right. all stuff you could see on video. But, you know, just so many of the epic matchups that were there at the time, him and Savage, previous to that, of course, him and Andre. It was
the whole Miss Elizabeth thing, like, you know.
Yeah. You know, the Orndorff feud of 86 that ended up, they did a stadium show in Toronto that was like sort of a quasi blow off.
Was it him and Hogan? Was it Orndorff and Hogan where they had the Saturday night's main event and his like feet didn't hit the ground for like 9/10 of a second or something stupid? Remember that? They had the slow motion.
It was a near tie. It was sort of a tease of what they would do with Bret Hart and Lex Luger at the 94 Royal Rumble. Supposedly, here's why. Is that they had, and in this way, Meltzer, I heard him talking about this on a podcast. He said it would have been disastrous if they had to go to this, and he's right, but it was all they had. If Andre's back was bad enough, because he was coming off of bad back surgery and he was really beat to crap, if Andre couldn't go at WrestleMania 3, then it would have been Orndorff. Because if I remember, I'm not sure if I remember this correctly, but I think that Saturday night's main event might have been at Cobalt Hall, so it was in the same market.
Okay.
So it was a thing where, That's an odd kind of a thing to do, because on a national stage, that was the closest thing they ever did to a blow-off, because the show at Exhibition Stadium in Toronto was not really televised anywhere. That was just a thing where they did it. It was a large stadium show in Toronto. It was a prototype for doing SummerSlam late summer, but it wasn't nationally put out there the way that a Saturday night's main event or a pay-per-view was. So yeah, so apparently that's why they did that with Orndorff. That was a little bit kind of a head scratcher, but
it was. I remember watching it like, really? This is how it's going to be?
Yeah, that was kind of bizarre. And then of course, the first big feud that he had in the national era, because again, he comes in 84, he beats the Iron Sheik, but that's not really a prolonged feud. He shows the first year with Big John Studd, Greg the Hammer Valentine, no prolonged feuds. The one that everyone remembers is Roddy Piper.
Yep.
And what's hilarious is that what the WWE did briefly in terms of rewriting history. So Piper passing away almost exactly 10 years before Hogan. I mean, it's very close on the dates. It was in July. And so this was right after Hogan's comments that came out. WWE had gone through that period of blacklisting him for like 3 years. And they did a retrospective magazine on Piper. And I think I actually bought the thing out of morbid curiosity.
Of course
and
you did.
Like, yeah. And I was like, if you thought that there's no way they could erase Hulk Hogan from this, you'd be wrong. Because I'm going through this, and they're portraying WrestleMania 1 and WrestleMania 2 as the saga of Roddy Piper against Mr. T. Like, what are we doing here?
Like,
that's the whole thing. So Hogan basically got the Benoit treatment for about 3 years.
Altogether. Listen, the WWE could do that. They're a little nicer than that now, but let's talk about the Unreal series on Netflix, because –
that's part of the legacy, is doing things like this now. Yeah.
And look, I like wrestling. I watch it fairly frequently. I'll hop in, pop out. I'm not going to watch every episode of every show. I'll watch a lot of the pay-per-views, not all of them. So I watch this basically as I would watch any other series on Netflix. That's how I treated this.
Sure.
I treated this as if I was not a WWE fan per se. I was treating this on, hey, I'm watching a new show. Do I want to continue watching this series?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, honestly, they fell short. The, you know, the particulars are on my website on sportsology.com.
Yes.
But here's where they fell short. There were a few things. So the more they showed what was happening in the match and just having somebody sort of commentate it, like whether it was Triple H talking about what was going on or one of the producers or whatever. We've already seen that footage. Yeah. Like, show us other backstage footage. They showed some, not enough. So that was one thing. I thought in a really weird moment, but this is kind of how this business is, I think, you know, Rhea Ripley wins the title and basically you've got, you know, Triple H, I'll just call him that, Paul Levesque, whatever. But I called him Paul in that because everybody got unmasked there, right? So
sure,
he's hugging her and he's saying nice things and he's looking at the time on his watch while he's doing it.
Yeah.
Like, honestly, Paul.
Yeah.
Wouldn't, like, unplug from everything and just have a nice conversation with her for a minute? You got to be, like, worried about maybe when the next match was. So yeah. That kind of, like, didn't sit well with me. And then something else that was just, like, there was more heat between Bruce Pritchard and the guy who used to be Abyss, who Chris runs Martin. The shows.
Yeah. Yeah.
Than actual, like, wrestlers and management. Yeah. And to me, that was, like, odd because – for the first Netflix match, I think the big match was CM Punk and Rollins, right?
Yeah.
And they cut that short. And because they had a whole time frame thing. And at the end, again, the guy who played Abyss, he was like talking to guys backstage. And he goes kind of like, I hope Bruce isn't mad because, you know, we canceled all these moves so we could get this done, you know, get it in time frame and.
Yeah.
And, you know, they all smoothed it over and everything. But you could tell Pritchard was not happy. He did something on the side and said, yeah, it ran long. Like he said, it ran long.
Yeah.
My whole thing is, why did it get to that point where if that, to me, now, again, I watched it, but I don't remember. I think that was the most important match, right? That was the big buildup.
It depends. Now, they had done earlier in the show. So, I mean, that was the main event. But earlier in the show, when they did Roman Reigns solo Sokoa.
Right, but know, that's early in the show.
But it, like, that clearly you had two main events, though. That's the one that was on last, so I guess that was the true main event.
Right, my feeling is...
The term co-main event is often overused, but I do feel like there was a co-main event for that show because it was so loaded up. But again, the whole point of Netflix is, hello, you can
run as long as you want.
Right. Why can't you run over, Russ? There's no over. We're off the air at 11 o'clock. You go off the air when you want to go over.
Right.
And Netflix, Netflix isn't going to be giving you the treatment here. No. Netflix wants you to give as much as you can in the course of this. And also,
So that struck me weird, right? It was like, why did this happen? So that was weird. I didn't like that. And here was the other weird part. If you're going to tell me that in episode one, and really, in what's coming in the future, hey, look, the wrestlers are great. They're great athletes.
Yeah.
I would never say anything bad about that. Yeah. They talked about themselves and stuff. That's great, too.
Yeah.
You don't have to give your whole life story, though. Everybody knows your real names. Everybody knows that stuff. Like, if you're a wrestling fan, you already know that. To me, it's like you're kind of wasting my time here on some of that.
Yeah.
But in the end, when you're showing, like, the coming attractions and even that first episode, are you trying to tell me there's no heat between the actual performers or the performers against management or anything? The wrestlers weren't mad that match got cut short. They didn't even look like they questioned anybody. Like, hey, what happened?
Yeah.
Like, come on. Like, it's just too sanitized for me to go on with it because I already feel like it's like the Michael Jordan documentary in a way.
Performers against management will be the first thing to be cut out of a show like that. If they do a subsequent edition of WWE Unreal, let's say they filmed stuff the night of the Hogan tribute. You know what's not going to make it to air? What's not going to make it to air is a wrestler being on there and like, well, I have to say, you know what part of Hulk Hogan's legacy is? Hulk Hogan, when Jesse Ventura tried to set up a union before WrestleMania 2 and Hulk Hogan busted the union, you're not going to hear about that. So don't tell me that the show is showing everything there.
That's my point. Don't call it unprecedented access or anything. It's only unprecedented for you because you're showing us more than you ever have, but it's not unprecedented. And as far as about the union thing, because we did talk about Hulk Hogan here, it was a bad look for him. But again, a guy who's getting away scot-free from this is The Rock. The Rock, I even tweeted to him the day that they had the big merger, and I was like, hey, you've got a lot of money here. We're talking about billions of dollars. Are you trying to tell me you can't have a union for the wrestlers. And of course, he was never going to answer me, but he's complicit too. Like, there should have been a union. Jesse was right. And there still should be a union.
They're all complicit in not hanging together on this whole thing here. And that's something where, again, what I want to tie this to, because this was something that you wanted to get to here, but I found the thread that ties this back into the Hulk Hogan thing, this Unreal thing. And that is, and just, I'm going to start off by making this point here. Just folks, go out there on YouTube and type in the phrase TNA law. Somebody did a thing of the, you remember the old LA law, you know, open that there would be? Somebody did a parody of it with TNA footage from back in the day. They did their own. Oh, this is backstage. This is whatever. Now, their TNA being TNA, it was horribly, laughably, whatever. But like back when Hogan was there and Bischoff and all those cheesy over actors back in the day and all that kind of stuff. And like Hulk Hogan actually ending his career as an in-ring wrestler in TNA, I always felt like that was actually fitting for his career. Because as somebody who went to WCW, and yes, Eric Bischoff would say this, that they could not have gotten to the heights that they got to in 96, 97, whatever, without him being there. That wouldn't have happened. But the deal with the devil, figuratively here, on like creative control and everything else like that, that's one of the big factors that led to them dying. And we go back to 2000.
Hey, listen, you know, to be fair, Piper was in TNA. I know this. Because Doug and I wrote the card backs for the TNA wrestling set with Pacific cards. And I wrote the back for the Roddy Piper one. I pulled one out of the box they gave me. So Piper probably ended his career there too, Rick.
No, because subsequently he came back to WWE with Flair. They were the tag team champions briefly.
Oh, okay.
Back so when there was two sets of tag team champions as there are now. But anyways, here's my point on this, that Hogan getting turfed in 2000 from WCW, it's fitting that he ends his career in TNA. Why? Because I've always described TNA as the tribute promotion to the dying days of WCW 99-01. That's what TNA is. Like, what if WCW continued to exist as they did in their rotten last 2 years? Yeah. They essentially did, but they called it TNA. And that's where Hogan ended his career. With the same kind of – him and Nash and everybody, like, they're doing it. Like, these are guys that were washed 10-plus years earlier. And, like, we're going to milk them in 2011 for all this kind of drama? Like, are you kidding me? As the world was continuing to evolve. So Hogan's – the remainder of his in-ring career and his – he was largely backstage.
Don't forget acting career. Don't forget about acting.
Yeah, who can ever forget
Thunder and Lightning.
Piece of, you know, Mr. Nanny and that kind of stuff.
Thunder and Lightning.
So it's a thing where, yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where, in a way, everything that we're saying about Hogan is – almost in a weird way, because pro wrestling is what pro wrestling is. Carny culture, you know, just spell my name right, brother. Well, we're talking about him. We're spelling his name right. And we're getting into all these different things, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And a lot of, and again, it, as we distinguish between Hulk Hogan and Terry Bollea on this here too, but the whole thing too, as it went along, and as you saw in Hogan in his later career, and some people will love it and some people will hate it, at the tail end of his lifetime, him becoming a political figure, we saw, for good, for bad, and for ugly, for all of that, the final full merger of Terry Bollea and Hulk Hogan. I mean, in the end, I think they were indistinguishable in the public eye, and that's part of his legacy. That's part of the very complicated legacy that he has. So there's people these days that don't like him for political reasons. There's reason that people don't like him for, you know, the racist things that, again, he never fully repented of. And that last, we'll never forget it, the night of the Netflix debut in L.A., getting booed out of the building there when he was ostensibly making a babyface appearance to promote his beer. He's actually going to have in a couple of weeks in Cleveland here, this real American wrestling thing, like him and Eric Bischoff and the other carnies that are involved in that. Hulk won't be there now, obviously.
I'm sure Jimmy Hart will.
Jimmy Hart will probably be there. Perhaps past lounge guest Brutus Beefcake, if he made nice at the 11th
hour. Maybe Greg the Hammer, you know.
Maybe he'll be there. So, yeah, so it's one of these things where, again, just this very, very, very complex picture of the man, of the whatever, somebody who, you know, who drew a lot of money but was never a great in-ring wrestler that said and did these things, whatever.
Hey, we all watched.
Like, we all watched. But and that's the thing. We all watched him. We couldn't take our eyes off of him. some of the worst stuff in WCW, you couldn't take your eyes off of him because it was a car crash, but it was like, but this is fitting. Like I'm saying all these things. And at the end of the day, I think he'd appreciate my bottom line, which is, did anybody ever more fully epitomize pro wrestling than this man? Pro wrestling itself, in a lot of ways, you don't want to dig too deep if you love it, because it's been a cesspool industry historically.
Although I will say this, I've interviewed probably, definitely dozens of wrestlers, you know, and they've all been great interviews.
Nice guys. Yeah. Nice guys.
And they're all like guys who really appreciate the art, and they all, you know, so they really do love the fans, like they do. And so like, I'll always say that and stick up for that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, and a lot of it is, when I talk about the cesspool part of the business, a lot of it is from folks that weren't as successful in the business that ended up kind of tainting it. Somebody that I watched, in my childhood, on Southwest Championship Wrestling, Mr. Piledriver, Bob Sweetan.
I don't even know him. Okay.
Come to find out the guy was convicted. By the way, this is on the record. He was convicted of being a diddler, also of his own kids. Rock and Roll Buck Zumhoff, the very same. Now, these are people that are not as famous, but they tainted the image of the business nonetheless. A lot of promoters with the scummy way to promote. So it's like, the business itself. Just, you referenced the show before, The Dark Side of the Ring. I mean, they could run that show for the next 100 years.
So oh, absolutely.
Like, so all these things that we're saying about Hogan, the good and the less than good and whatever, like he just seems to epitomize the business as a whole. The business as a whole is very complex. The business as a whole, you know, shades of gray, brother. Like, and that's the whole thing. You look at it, and ironically, Hogan never really did much as a tweener. Maybe briefly in '99 when they were at their, you know, creative worst. Yeah. But you know, again, this is just one of these things where he epitomizes the business, and that's a thing. Where do you mean that as a good thing or a bad thing? I mean, I just mean that as a thing for a
while. It's just a thing. I agree. Just a thing.
Yeah, and again, like I said, I mean, and for all the sick kids that were out there, that you know, he did the stuff for the charitable foundations and everything.
Yeah, that's great.
That. Like, there are people who only knew him through that lens, and I'm not going to take anything away from those experiences. Yeah. I mean, that's the only thing that's important to them. I've always judged people by, you know, if they're nice to me, that has meant that I have been friends with people that some people have loathed or whatever, or just like maybe not liked as much. And I'm like, oh, that guy was nice to me. That's all I'm going to go by. So we're saying all these things knowing the full public image of him. There are people who had personal experiences with
him. Hey, I just said I had a good personal experience, and he could have blown me off in 2 seconds because I was a new hockey writer. I was just in it for like 3 years.
Yeah.
He didn't know me from Adam. You know, went up to him. He could have just said, hey, I'm busy.
Sportsology. That's a jabroni site, brother. Yeah. He could have big timed you. He did.
Yeah.
So on the micro level, we're talking the macro level stuff we know. I'm going to point out on the micro level, there's people all over the country, perhaps even all over the world, who had one-on-one experiences with him or in small groups or whatever that were anything but the things that we're talking about here. So that's part of the public record as well, the good that he did and everything like that. And again, I freely admit coming into this just being sort of jaded as, you know, a smart mark kind of a fan. I mean, I always say with a great deal of chagrin, you know, who was my favorite wrestler at one time? Chris Benoit. So, you know, that was, you know, I never stopped
being Bruno, but did I like Hogan? Yeah, I liked him, of course.
It was like maybe briefly when I was a kid, but I mean, I outgrew that pretty fast. I always said, and this was kind of funny, that like, for as much as people look back on this at, you know, like, what were they thinking as far as Starrcade 87, Ronnie Garvin having a title? I'm here to tell you, as an NWA fan, that guy was over. And I'll tell you what, growing up,
he could wrestle. I've seen Ronnie Garvin enough. He could wrestle.
And I'm a fan of guys who like do things that differentiate themselves and make it work. Nobody worked like Ronnie Garvin. Ronnie Garvin, when you watch the match of his, it was unique. And I'm here to tell you,
Harley Race was like that.
At my school, in the blue collar suburb of Parma, Ohio, Ronnie Garvin was probably more over than Hulk Hogan.
Yeah.
So it's a thing where it kind of, you had your regional loyalties even then back in the day.
I'm a Long Island guy. We knew about Mick Foley forever.
Yes. And he was somebody where, again, before he hit the national stage. So,
and it took him a while.
Yeah. So, I mean, me being an NWA guy back in the day, so I'm conscious of all of my biases about Hulk Hogan. And I'm free. But the whole thing, we've always said with day one from the FDH Lounge, from when we started in 07, disclose your biases, put them out there, and then do the best you can to kind of break down things from there. So I come at this, from somebody where my point of view is not to be, you know, pro a lot of things Hulk Hogan as far as his career. Like I said, I don't want to shovel any more dirt that I did on the dead, but like as far as his career goes, I'm not inclined to be the biggest fan of that, and that's what he's the best known for, even after all the other stuff came out. But again, I have to, a commercial success on the highest level, and he was somebody where, and in the great pro wrestling tradition, right? What could be more pro wrestling than going to WCW and milking that whole thing as though you were still Hulk Hogan circa 85?
Right.
Mind effing Eric Bischoff into believing that you still had that level of draw.
Oh, yeah. He was.
You got to take your hat off to the man.
You do. No, yeah, absolutely.
That takes skill. I may not like it as, you know, the kind of fan that I am, but you have to take your hat off to it. Once again, what is that? Quintessential pro wrestling. The man embodied it. And again, you, Russ Cohen, certainly somebody who embodies and loves pro wrestling as well, covered very, very well through the years at Sportsology.
Yeah, on and off when I can. Yeah, I love it.
That's part of the rubric of what you guys cover there. And as alluded to at the outset, 11-time author as well. The 11th one coming out not super long ago, so make sure you talk about that right here.
Yeah, it's called Game Winners. It's the best game-winning goals of all time with the NHL, also includes Olympics, so it's got a good mix in there. No Cleveland Barons. Sorry, Rick.
And Iserman's shot.
I say that because I know who you really root for. So,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. We do not have Iserman's shot from 96 against St. Louis in there either. But I haven't gotten a chance to read yet. I look forward to reading what could plausibly be 50 better goals than that one.
Here we go. All right, well, read it and then get back to me and we'll argue about it. I'll get Matthew on here. We'll argue it with you.
That'll be good. Yes. That's my homework assignment. I'm gonna sit down and read the book, and then we'll have you back on for that. I look forward to that. But always a great pleasure to get you on the show. The first of the post-original FDH Lounge dignitaries, my good friend Russ Cohen. Thank you so much, Russ, for being here. And thank you, everybody, for checking out FDH Lounge mini episode 1850.